Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Ben Hunter.
Hello.
And we're very excited because we've got Meg and Tom Keneally here again, which is awesome.
Hello.
I love the fact that you guys are publishing regularly so that we get to see you again and again and again.
You can't get rid of us.
Yeah, well, the great thing is that you've got a book coming up as well.
Yes.
Another one. Tom's had another book come out. You guys are so prolific. It's marvellous. We're here to talk about the Monster Rat series and the new book, Inkstain. Mm-hmm. Now, we can get everyone up on what's going on, can you give a little tiny bit of a background to the Montserrat series?
The central character is Hugh Llewellyn Montserrat, who's a ticket of leave gentleman convict who finds himself in a position of travelling to penal stations around Australia to solve inconvenient crimes that they don't want to leave to the local constabulary. And his success rate has to be high, because if it isn't, he loses his freedom and he'll be back at a penal station himself. But the real brains of the operation is his housekeeper and friend, Hannah Mulrooney, who is a feisty Irish woman who's in the habit of whacking him with a tea towel if she thinks he's being stupid. So they find themselves going from penal station to penal station solving these murders, and in this book they find themselves in Sydney.
So where have they been so far? What's the...
Port Macquarie, first up, then Parramatta Female Factory, and then Maria Island in Tasmania.
Where you and my wife... Mm-hmm. Your mother had ancestors.
Yeah, I'm descended from a female factory convict. And this time Sydney, then they are going to go to a penal station near Dubbo, which was a penal station for educated convicts, gentlemen convicts, and as a result was referred to as the Valley of the Swells, so we won't have to hunt too hard for a title for that one.
Great.
And then probably Norfolk Island, where we're planning to reunite Montserrat with an old nemesis.
Oh, brilliant.
Yes. So.
And this is like, you guys are writing these books, this is pretty much every year, and then you're also writing other books pretty much every year. So how are you managing this together? I mean, is it easier writing these books because you're working as a team, or is it just that you're so prolific, they're just like stories coming out of it.
It is easy if you've got a child slave like Meg, a former journo who's used to producing lots of text. Yes, it's we're both quite. Every novelist has a different time fuse, you know. Really good ones often have time fuses of 20 or 25 years. Mm. Fortunately, as a working class lad with vices and children to raise, I had to produce around about a book a year. I knew that, but that's about my fuse. Mm-hmm. My last novel, Two Old Men Dying, it had two stories in it, and making two stories work together and parallel each other while being organic to each other, that is a test that normally takes you. That took me 18 months or more. Mm-hmm. But Meg's even, as a former journalist, has an even greater level of output. And we've all got vices and weaknesses and strengths, and Meg's strengths is narrative pace. Mm-hmm. She's got better narrative pace than her old man, which keeps things humming along in the Montserrat series. And I have to admit that because I had a serious operation last year, my input into this one is not inconsiderable, but it's not as high as I would have liked it to be.
So it's just like we just had a signing with you guys, and just like the speed there, it was like Meg just powered through those, and then Tom was chatting away and a bit slower. You're emailing Dad going, hey, dude, where's your response to what I just sent you?
Well, fortunately, we live quite close to each other, and we both like bushwalking.
Yeah.
So if we have anything really thorny to discuss about the book, we go for a walk.
Yeah,
and it tends to, you know.
Then we work face to face with our computers if we've reached an impasse.
Stages, yeah.
But that's mainly been the editing stages. Yeah.
Yeah, so generally what happens is we plot it out together over a walk, and then I generally whack out the first draft and then the second draft, because my first draft's a dog's breakfast that no one will ever see, so including Dad. So, you know, go through and fix all the typos, delete the paragraphs where you reread it and think, what the hell was I writing? You know?
Yeah.
And then Dad and I work on them together.
So Meg's aware of my flaws. Meg has a tendency to start chapters in the middle of conversation.
Yeah.
And then only gradually do you find who the people are.
Yeah.
And I tend to want them identified up front. So that is a that's a difference of of technique.
And I think I probably do it too much.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing to sort of keep the pace up, to drop somebody into the middle of the scene.
Yes, it works when it works.
When it works,
really.
It works, but you can overuse it. And I think I've overused it in the past. And fortunately, I've got Dad to pull me up. The other, Dad is much, much, much better than me at writing in general, but particularly at place. I'm not a natural when it comes to sense of place, and I've had to, you know, school myself on that. But Dad's got a particular facility with developing sense of place.
Do you feel that in your, because you're writing books by yourself outside of this series, do you feel that there's influences that way? And do you feel, Meg, that there's influence coming the other way? So in both your writing standalone.
Well, I certainly feel very influenced by Dad and his thought processes. And one of the really instructive experiences I had, there were many, it was like a personal masterclass writing with him, obviously. When we were writing The Soldier's Curse, the first book in the series, I had written...
Set in Port Macquarie, set in Port the Macquarie. Penal settlement in...
Mm-hmm.
The murder of the commandant's young wife,
where it all started. And I had written Mrs. Mulrooney as someone who gets annoyed at inanimate objects really easily. She tells off the kettle. If she was a contemporary character, she'd swear at her computer, as I may or may not have done this morning. And Dad read that draft and said, look, that's all fine, but what if you say she does that because it's misplaced anger? She's angry at the people who have put her in this situation, but she can't express that to them or she'll find herself back on bread and water. So she takes it out on the skillet.
Yeah.
And that deepened it from a character quirk to something which was indicative of a deeper part of her personality.
Mm.
And ever since then, I've looked for opportunities to try to do that and sort of tried to guard against just having a sort of gimmicky little character flaw thrown in there.
Yeah.
So that was really, you know, a wonderful learning experience for me. And focusing more on sense of place is the kind of thing that Dad's taught me as well.
Oh, thank you, Meg. I wasn't aware, but it's great to know that I once met a Booker Prize winner, Kiran Desai, in Calcutta, and she said, winning the Booker Prize put paid... to the suspicion she'd had while writing all her books that she wasn't really a novelist. They thought she was a novelist, so she must be.
Yeah.
And when another writer, even your daughter, maybe especially your daughter, says something like that, it's very affirming, Meg.
And do you feel the effect writing these books and seeing how Meg is making sure everything moves at a pace, do you feel that being translated in some of your work?
Well, I haven't explicitly thought that, but it's very likely because, you know, last time we met, you flattered me by saying that my last book was the best thing I've ever written.
Yes.
Now, I wrote it in my 80s. I'm 83 now. And I think the last, that book... The book I've just finished and a book I'm writing now do have narrative pace, and I might have caught it from Meg.
Yeah.
It might be a talent I caught from my daughter.
Well, there is an assistance. I remember when I first got involved with the editing process, and the editor was let's just move this along a bit, and she sort of showed me a couple of techniques on how to do that, and so I started to really pop it in the back of my head as, oh my God, yes, there is someone here who's got the TV and their phone, everything going off. Mm. They've got a busy life. Everyone's so busy these days. Keep them on the page, John. You know, and so this idea, there's a kind of a, and it's, when we read so many of these books that have been published, there seems to be an insistence on that. You know, the editors and the publishers are saying, we're competing for their attention. So, really grip them here and keep them on the page.
Yeah.
Whereas in the past, you may not have had to consider that or worry as much, because people picking up a novel, expecting the novel to take time and to move at its own pace and for you to get into it like a
luxury. Have you felt that editorial pressure over the course of your career?
Not, I mean, that they pretty much, they're very respectful editors, or at least they say they are, and they're calm, and they and I've felt that there used to be, when I was young, it was fashionable to be an alienated writer. All the good writers were alienated. Patrick White was extremely alienated, both from Australia, from modern society, and the human race. He had three great alienations in his work. And his work, was gloriously demanding, in my opinion. But a lot of people claim it's too demanding and too kind of undemocratic. I'm not one of them. I love his work, but there was a lot of contempt for the reader in my day. No one can afford contempt for the reader anymore. But it's funny what readers, trying to predict what readers will go for is, I think, a mug's game. You sort of write for someone who's a bit like yourself, only younger and better looking and better qualified. And
like you, John.
And you have this ideal. You do have a composite of the ideal reader, and he's definitely a bloke who reads, a man or woman who reads Peter Carey and reads all the Barbara King Solver, who's one of my faves, and reads all the great English novelists. Hopefully he doesn't read too much Julian Barnes, but
sorry, Julian.
But he's the bloke I'm pitching, the man, the woman, the chosen spirit to whom you're pitching. And then for the weekend, a well-written, the point about the prose in Montserrat, we wanted it to be good. And we argue a lot over, I mean, we discuss stylistic, that we've never had a screaming match or anything approaching it. We generally cure each other's writing solecisms by irony and mockery.
Yes.
Good.
Passive-aggressive stuff.
Yeah.
Which is actually more damaging in the long
run. Dad thinks I have a habit of anthropomorphising things a bit much, of giving human characteristics to inanimate objects. So he likes to tease me about the dancing teacups. He's like, "Oh, you're bringing on the dancing teacups."
Like Fantasia. No, but and I have similar flaws of prolixity and, but this one. It helps to have written the histories of Australia that I did, because when you're going through the history of Australia, you see things that would make a great book. And I always thought that the gentlemen convicts were a great subject. The gentleman convict I was interested in was James Tucker, the first convict novelist from Port Macquarie, who wrote Ralph Rashleigh. And he had a tragic life in the convict system because he wasn't a detective like Montserrat. And we forget how narky everyone was towards gentlemen convicts. And, you know, if a gentleman convict comes up against a sort of colonial version of Dutton or something like that, then you...
Of which
there were many who believed in the fundamental fallenness of the fallen.
Yeah.
And so we've got a right-wing monster in this book called Darling. He never really appears much.
No, we mention the governors throughout, but they're never going to step into the
yeah.
stage because I think
they're background characters.
Yeah.
And he tried to take on the press, as you know.
And that's
he tried to reverse all the liberal democratic damage Brisbane that Macquarie put in place and Brisbane let continue. He was going to put an end to all that. And that's where our books come from. His conflict, very dramatic conflict with the newspaper business.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then to make sure that gentlemen convicts did proper time and didn't get away with being a fancy smanchy clerk to someone,
yeah.
He founded this convict station at Wellington in New South Wales near Dubbo for gentlemen convicts, the so-called Valley of the Swells, which we've now got four of these out, or is it five?
Four.
And we're going to give it a 2-year break till the next one.
Okay.
To try to let readers catch up. But one of the wonderful things that happens with a mystery series that I wasn't conscious of is that if you've got the same characters, the books go on sale for much longer than with a straight novel.
Yes. Yeah.
And this isn't the reason to write general nonfiction against mysteries, but it is, you know, I'm very dependent in this operation on Meg's logic, creativity, and her swiftness of uptake.
Yeah.
Very swift uptake, and she can write some days 3,000 or 4,000 words a day of a draft.
Do you think on social media, the great thing about writing at the moment is that if someone likes your stuff, they can tell you straight away that it's come on social media and go, yeah. Hey, Toe, I really like your book.
Yeah.
But what was interesting about when you build up a series of books, and what is kind of heartbreaking for the author sometimes is, I borrowed the book from the library and holy hell, it was great. So I got all the others out and I read them all in a week. You spent 5 years putting this thing together. Someone tells you they read the whole series in a week. But it's great because you know that someone's really enjoying
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but we'd rather hear they'd read them.
Yeah.
Actually, most of us, and this is our downfall, we'd rather hear they'd read them rather than they paid for them and not read them.
Yeah.
And
except for Peter Fitzsimons, he actually tells us on video here that I don't care if you read it, just buy it. Yeah. As you know, writers, you'd much prefer hearing someone's actually
absolutely engaged with it.
But it's that immediacy that we now have. Mm. So the worst part of this immediacy is if they don't like it, they sometimes just come out and tell you.
Yes,
my wife and I fancy ourselves as elderly jocks, you know, and so we still cross-country ski, and we're out in fairly remote California up near Squaw Valley cross-country skiing one day. Beautiful, most exquisite country. Place called, whatever it's called. And two people skied up, and they got talking, and then she said, I'm doing a book book group at the moment by an Australian writer called Thomas Keneally, who is, and I thought, oh, it's sure to be Schindler's List, that's the only book anyway. And she said, it's Woman of the Inner Sea, which is a book I wrote in the 90s. And that is worth travelling a long way to get that. I didn't go to that remote peak to get that because it could take you 2,000 years to meet someone who was in a book club who was actually reading one of your books. But that was heaven.
Must be a thrill, yeah.
Yes.
I love that book.
Well,
one of my favourites of yours.
Thank you. So, but again, the great thing about Montserrat and Mrs. Mulrooney that we can, they're there from Port Macquarie to Maria Island to Parramatta, the female factory. And by the way, the female factory is one of the reasons I'm not voting for the state government at the next elections, because we have a magnificent heritage site there with buildings designed by the convict Greenway, and nearly 2 million Australians are descendants of women who went through the various convict female factories. We had a day out there where they put up a memorial to the women. They just put up all their first names. Wonderful little wall. And Mary Bashir was there. She didn't have. But John Pilger turned up. And he has an ancestor, two ancestors in the female factory. The school teacher in the female factory and a convict. And you can see him. He's still rattling the bars, good old John, and you can see where it comes from. And there were extraordinary people who were presenting themselves. Yeah. So who's the historian?
What's the government doing with it?
Well, nothing yet. You can't visit it, but there are plans to combine development with a heritage site. For example, I mean, in the history of Australian feminism, which is one of the world's smallest books, of course, some would say, in terms of its impact on us males, or on males, the male hegemony, if you want to call it that, there is a place there where that belonged to the third class women. Now, the idea of dividing women into first, second, and third class women is a fascinating concept in the history of sort of Anne Summers' God's Damned Whores and God's Police. And you realise that some of the women in the third class were victims of male malice. They didn't come across for a particular warder, or they were strident in defence of their rights, and some of them were very strident. Meg's Got a Convict Woman. Oh, sorry, it's my book too, isn't it? Yeah, we've got a convict woman called Grace O'Leary, named after the famous female pirate of the 16th century, Grace Gronje O'Leary.
O'Malley.
O'Malley, of course, not O'Leary. She is based on convict women in there who stood up for rights. And you know what? They were generally Irish.
Yeah, all the good troublemakers are.
Yeah. And including Mrs. Mulrooney.
Yeah.
God bless her. Illiterate but totally intuitive and deductive heart.
Yeah. Not brilliant. Illiterate anymore.
No, she's learned to read. And will Montserrat get back to Grace O'Malley?
O'Leary.
O'Leary. Or both. From what I've heard, they're both trumpets.
Meg and Tom, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure having you here.
Thank you for having us.
And you can get hold of all of Meg and Tom's Montserrat series at booktopia.com.au and all of Tom's books here as well.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes, And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.